Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins. It's been a big week for the podcast. We've hit 500,000 listens, more than 500,000 times someone has clicked on listen now. It's incredible to think when I started this podcast as really a means for me to keep in touch with the Camino, that it continues to resonate with so many people. Can I just say thank you? I am most grateful for your support, your kindness. This is going to be what they call a three-peat. I've missed only one podcast in almost 4 years, and to fill that void, I was on the road and I couldn't do it. And I didn't have any recordings in the can, as they say, so I had to reload my interview with Noel Braun. So out of 150 episodes, I chose Noel because I find his story extraordinary. Well, I'm delighted to say Noel is back this week to talk about a new book. But before we get to Noel, this is a podcast about the Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James. The Camino is a pilgrimage. People from all over the world go to Europe to walk in the footsteps of Christ's apostle St. James. What's not to love about that sentence? People from all over the world going to Europe to walk in the footsteps of Christ's apostle St. James. You walk to your own rhythm, your own time, to the beat of your heart. What's not to love about walking to the beat of your heart? Some pilgrims write, some document their way in pictures, sometimes in song. It's the global sharing of the common experience that draws us all together. And not only drawing us together, it helps us share our experience to the rest of the world. But walking is the key. Moving, travelling, progressing, creating a future, a destination. Linda Hogan is an American poet and Indigenous writer, and she wrote, "Walking, I am listening to a deeper way. Suddenly all my ancestors are behind me. Be still, they say. Watch and listen. You are the result of the love of thousands." Just pause for a moment. You are the result of the love of thousands. Who is our great-great-grandmother? What music did she listen to? Our great-great-great-grandfather, what did he do? How did their love, their lives, shape our lives? I like to think I walk my pilgrimage for them, with them, and, in a way, to them. I'll bring in this week's guest, Noel Braun, whose new book is called Keep Pressing On, Brother. He's on the line. Welcome, Pilgrim.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you very much for coming back to me again.
Yes, it's a pleasure. What do you make, what do you think when you hear this week's quote, "Walking, I am listening to a deeper way. Suddenly all my ancestors are behind me. Be still, they say. Watch and listen. You are the result of the love of thousands."
Yes, I can relate to that. I would see walking in many ways as a meditation, and it has the potential to be the most creative part of the day, because you're able to draw on inspiration, not only from the work, from the walking, but also from all of that wisdom and philosophy which you've just mentioned there. And I know there are other philosophers down the ages that have extolled the virtues of working. I think Kierkegaard, Swedish philosopher, mentioned that this was the most, walking was the most creative part of his journey. This is where he really was able to generate new thoughts and ideas. And I can imagine drawing on the inspiration from all the people that have, walked before you, and from all of your, all of the, traditions of your particular culture, as you mentioned in the, the Indigenous American culture, so I can relate to that.
Yeah, we have lots to learn always, don't we?
Definitely. Yeah. I know by now I've really accepted at my age that the older I get, the less I know, the more there is to know.
And that's exciting.
Yeah, so I always approach things as far as I can. Mind you, I've got my prejudices, of course, but I always approach issues and things which as open a mind as possible, because there's always something that one can learn.
Yeah.
And that's certainly what you're doing when you're on the Camino.
That's for sure.
You're learning all the time.
Yeah, learning all the time and growing and sharing.
And growing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's certainly sharing.
Yeah,
too.
That's right. Noel, yeah. It's helpful to cast our minds back from time to time. You were a country school teacher. For our international listeners, a country school teacher means you're out in the bush, and it can be a very solitary yet rewarding experience. What did you learn then that still resonates with you now?
You're going back many years, Dan. But the first 4 years of my working life, I taught in these little one-teacher schools where I had all grades in the one room, from five-year-olds up to 14-year-olds. You were the voice of education for those particular kids, and they're usually in fairly remote localities. My own particular experience, I was a city boy. I was born and bred in Melbourne, and I remember wanting to get away from Melbourne just for the experience of running my own little school. So what happened there, of course, the great learning curve, it was really a great learning curve, because you were thrown on your own, you know, brand new to the profession, and you had to learn everything and to be completely self-sufficient and self-resourceful. So I think I learned a lot of how to be self-resourceful. In a way, it spoilt me, because 4 years of making every decision, I could never handle a boss after that. You know, if the boss did what I thought should be done, that was fine. But when the boss wanted to do it a different way, that's when I used to feel uncomfortable.
That's a great story. We're going to get to your passion for writing, because that's really where it was sort of born or stems from as well. But just in answering that question, you said you were hungry or very keen to leave Melbourne. And I wonder if all those years ago it was a little snapshot of that person in you that is searching for something, that there's a wider world that you want to see and experience, and still doing it today.
Yes. Well, I wanted to move out of, the confines of the big city way back in the '50s it was. And interesting, this is where I've finished up, because right now I live in a little, little town in the Snowy Mountains in the south-east of Australia. I regard myself as a refugee from the big cities. 7 years ago I moved to this little place, and I feel very comfortable in a way back where I sort of wanted to be.
Yeah.
Way back there in my early 20s.
Yeah, how fantastic.
It's taken a while, but...
Yeah. A lot of what you learned back then became the theme for your first book, Friend and Philosopher, and it tells the story of that journey, because in many ways the teacher in a one-teacher school in a community like that is a friend and a philosopher.
Yes. Well, that title came from the wisdom of the Teachers College lecturers, who used to say, you know, to us young aspiring teachers, the country school teacher should be the friend and philosopher of the district. And in the book I wrote, I created this a character, young lad, as raw as they come, wanting to be the friend and philosopher of the particular districts in the little school that he went to. So he faces a series of challenges. He's not quite up to it all, but he keeps pressing on and keeps inspiring. And I think I've had great feedback. It's my favourite book, actually. It's in its third print, and you know, it's still people want to read it, and I've had great feedback from it. So. So it's set the ball rolling,
yeah,
for me, you know, for that was six books ago. And it only, I always had this during my career, I always had these aspirations to be, you know, be a published author one of these days. And, of course, many people say one of these days and never got around to it. I say one of these days and eventually. It may take decades, but eventually we get around to it. So I published that first book in 2004, it was. It was a novel. I was planning to write novels. And then I wrote the second one.
Whistler Street.
Whistler Street, that's right. It came out about 2007. By that time, an event occurred that completely changed the whole course of my life, and that was the suicide of my wife, Maris.
That's right, and the following book was the memoir, No Way to Behave at a Funeral.
That's right.
So you've told us this story before. It was a few years ago now. But I wondered if you'd tell us again. Tell us the story of Maris.
Well, Maris suffered depression, and she, you know, she hit a depression, and only a few people knew of you know, the constant battle that she had with the demons. And for her, every day was a struggle, particularly in the last. A year or so, and her two sisters had already died by suicide. She said she would never follow them, but I think the pain and anguish was just too intense for her, and she finally took her own life. To the outsider, she had everything to look for. She died a week before the wedding of my son Stephen, so that was a pretty rough time, I think. She died on a Saturday. We had the wedding on. Sorry, we had the funeral on the Thursday and the wedding on the Saturday. So, but somehow or other, we got through it, and the family got all through it. So that prompted me to write that book. It was therapy for me, but I know for the feedback that it's been a great assistance for other people who have been on that similar journey. And then, of course, that set me off on the search for meaning, which set me off on the pilgrimage route, following the Camino de Santiago. So that now I've walked six different routes and written three books about it. So I was a bit worried about this last one, Keep Pressing On, Brother, as after two books, as to whether I had anything new to say. But I think this one goes a little bit deeper into the spiritual journey.
Yes, it does. It does.
Yeah.
Hey, before we move on to the third exploration of the Camino that you've now written, the memoir is called No Way to Behave at a Funeral. Why?
Yes.
What's the title? Why the?
That's a piece of black humour. It was an incident that happened at the funeral. When we were all in the car going from the church to the cemetery, After penting up the emotions there, we let off a bit of steam in the car, shouting out at the tops of our voices and using, I don't know that I should use the words that we used, they were profanities. And then someone said, no way, that's no way to behave at a funeral, you know, with all this profanity. and someone said, who cares?
Yeah.
So we just continued to shout this out all the way, you know, the couple of 3 or 4 kilometres between the church and there. So that's where the title.
Yeah.
That's where the title came from, that one.
Can I ask you something, Noel?
Yeah.
Does a husband ever come to terms with something like that? Or do you simply live with it? Because I think there's a distinction there, isn't there? Could you possibly come to terms with it?
For me, no.
I thought so.
I more or less, you know, people were suggesting to me there at one stage about, you know, forming another relationship, but I thought that would do an injustice to that particular lady because I'd always be comparing them with my wife, Maris. It's something that you live with. And every now and then, you know, and you mosey along, every now and then it takes something to trigger off things. You know, it could be anything. It could be a song. Could be I went to a training conference once and the presenter told a suicide joke, of all things. That really set me off. I thought I had to leave, but then I went up to him, the guy afterward, and said, listen, mate, you have to be careful who's in your audience when you tell a suicide joke. Incidents like that. But then there's always, on the other hand, there's gentle reminders. I think the transition for people, you know, as they're working their way through the grieving, is that when they focus more upon the life of their loved one who's departed rather than on the death and the circumstances of the death.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah. That's a lovely way to talk about it about it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've got constant reminders of Maris in my house. I've got 12 photos of her around the place, you know, and I talk to her. And I've got a couple of little shrines with candles, and I like candles sometimes. Oh. Like it was her anniversary on the 30th of October. So I lit candles for her.
Yeah.
And
I think she'd be proud of you.
Well, hopefully. And I'll often think, okay, here's a situation, a little decision, and I often think now, what would Maris have done? Yeah, so
that's great. Oh, what a lovely thought.
Like, for example, it was one of my granddaughter's birthdays, and the only thing I could do was give her some money, you know, because it's very hard to buy for teenage girls. So I just gave her some money, and I heard Maris's voice saying, double it. So I did.
That's so great.
Much to my granddaughter's delight.
Thanks, Grandma. Thank you, Grandma. That's awesome. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, exactly.
So we talked here last time we spoke about how you were in France, I think, and you noticed some pilgrims wandering past and wondered what all the fuss was about, and that's how it led you onto your Camino.
Yeah, that's right. I was
journey.
I went to Chambéry in the French Alps, and I enrolled in a French language school, and each Sunday I'd go to the cathedral for Mass, and every now and then there was a group being, with their backpacks and their shells on their backs being blessed, getting their pilgrim's blessing, and they were off to Santiago. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. One of these days, I'll do that. And it took 4 years.
What made you finally do it? If it was one of the situations where you talked about before, one of these days, what was it that finally made you say, no, I'm going to do it?
Okay, well, I thought it was something to focus on in terms of planning and seeking structure. I did quite a bit of reading about the concept of pilgrimage and the idea of people finding themselves, and I felt definitely I needed to, you know, find myself and resurrect myself in some ways.
Because this is after Maris has died, isn't it?
Years afterwards, yeah. And that's why I went to France to learn French. And it's a ongoing process of rediscovering yourself and your identity. It's sort of and searching for meaning and challenging every belief and assumption that you've ever held. Everything I read about the Camino and pilgrimage, I thought, well, this is a way to go. So each year came and went, you know, before I went. And then finally, I think one November, or I said, I've got to make a decision. So I went down to the agent and booked the flight, you know, for the following year. You know, when you get one of these, like, I think at that time they were giving it early bird discounts.
Right.
For the flight, so I thought, okay, I booked the flight, so I was committed.
There you go. And you were always a walker, weren't you? So you've always been a walker, yes.
Yes, and a bit of a gym junkie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was a matter of focusing there, but it was as much spiritual preparation too. Mainly the idea of stepping out of a comfort zone. Being prepared to accept that I was in control, and I that can take a bit of working on yourself to accept, because I reckon I'm a slow learner in that area, you know, and also it took sort of that 4 years to sort of get myself ready.
Yeah.
And finally there, and I think in my first book about the Camino, The Day Was Made for Walking, the very first sentence says I was shit scared, because I was on the steps of the cathedral at Le Puy, and I looked down, and it was a great flight of steps right down, and then down below there was this narrow alley way that you walk down to it, and I was ready to chicken out there, but I thought, well, there's only one thing I can do, take a step. So of course I took the first step down and then second step, so then we were off. Away we went.
Now you've published three explorations of the Camino de Santiago, the day was made for walking, I guess I'll just keep on walking. And the third one now, the reason we're talking today, is keep pressing on, brother.
That's right.
So I want to talk about the new book, but just sort of more generally, do you find it easy to capture on the page the experience of the Camino?
Yes. I think I have a gift to, translate emotion into words, to describe the scenes. And I always, one of the questions I always pose to me, if I attempted to write down, I looked out and the scene was beautiful, I always ask my question, why? So I write down the reasons I might, and rather than saying the scene was beautiful, I'll just describe it as I see it, hear it, feel it. And I think I've successfully do that, and to such an extent that the feedback I get from many readers is that they almost feel as if they're walking with me. I've been able to absorb them into the scene, and I value that gift.
Yeah.
To be able to do that.
Yeah. And I suppose that when I posed in the question, do you find it easy to capture the Camino? I don't suppose it's easy, but you have a process and you can apply yourself in a sort of workmanlike way to achieve it.
It's not random.
No.
You have to work on it. I always value in the process of writing, always value feedback. Like, for example, the latest book, Keep Pressing on Brother, I got a lady to have a look at the manuscript, and every now and then she would pose the question, I'd like to know more about that. You know, explain that point a bit more.
Yeah.
Or that, I found that excellent feedback, because it really, disciplined me to, rather than just leave, a fairly vague open comment, to be far more explicit in the detail and in what I meant to say.
Mm.
And I was... from the few people who have read it so far, I've had some, very good feedback, so I feel encouraged.
Yeah.
To get out there and say, this is a good read.
No, it is a good read. Yeah. It is a good read.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved about what you do is a simple narrative, and there's enough information there for people to... Yeah, you're right. Feel as if they're walking alongside you, but also to undertake their own journey in your writing. Mm. And I think there's enough space in your writing to do that. And that's very important. And I want to just touch on that, because you and I met in October last year at the Camino conference in Adelaide. And
that's right.
A woman sat at the table and said she had been inspired to walk the Camino after seeing you talk at her local library.
So, yes.
So those talks, those presentations, is that you talking about your books? Is it talking about your pilgrimage? Is it talking about the Camino? Tell us about those presentations.
Yes. Well, for two or three years, I was tripping all over the Australia, actually, talking at libraries. And... that was sort of pre-COVID. Haven't done much this year. But I'd work that into what else I was doing. Like, so when my son was married in Perth, I organised a talk to about nine different libraries in Perth while I was there. And when my sister turned 90 up in Queensland, I organised to talk to a few libraries there, and then and down in Victoria and New South Wales. And, of course, while I was over there in Adelaide for that conference you just mentioned, I lined up a few Adelaide libraries, and also a few along the way, driving over. I always tried to pitch my talk to the people who turned up, and I'd always ask them, why are you here? I'd make a joke, something like, well, it's not raining. aren't there better things to do? So, and occasionally I'd even... you know, if they're all sitting there deathly quiet, you know, I thought, well, let's break, see if we can warm this group up. I'd often say to them, okay, just before we start, just say good day to your neighbour here and talk about why you're here. And, you know, that usually got them going. Then you had to shut them up then. So, and it also depended on how the library promoted it. Now, some promoted, you know, it was just the Camino. Okay. Some promoted it as the idea of a senior, resilient senior. Some focused on the mental health aspects, how a person coped with three suicides in the family. And you'd get inspiration. And I would encourage people to ask questions very early. And then I knew what they wanted to know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it was very much aiming at very early interaction with the, you know, with the group that were there. And sometimes there was only about three or four in the country. And in the city, you know, there were some groups of 100 plus.
Right.
You know, filling the...
Yeah.
I was amazed at the numbers that came to the libraries at Perth. And I think the library people, they were surprised too, you know, that it attracted so much interest. Many of the people in the audience, of course, had done the Camino themselves.
Yeah.
Or were thinking about it. I used to ask people, who's done the Camino? Who's thinking about it? Who would like to do it? But, and then who's never heard of it? You know, then the ones who'd never heard of it, I'd say, well, why are you here? You know, some of those were those who came to everything at the.
Well, I'm sure of that. Yeah, I'm certain of that. Tell us about the writing. The writing process, walking as a writer, are you always looking for ideas? Do you take notes in a journal and piece it together later? And this new book, Keep Pressing On, Brother, how did the story of that journey emerge for you?
Yes. Well, I keep a journal every evening. I'd try and spend, you know, 15 minutes or so. Just noting the day. Then I always carried a little notebook in my pocket shirt pocket. If I got a brilliant idea, what I thought was a brilliant idea along the way, I'd quickly scribble something down there and then. And then I took copious photographs. So when looking back, the photographs now are all sort of dated and timed. I was able to recreate every day. And then I'd look at the guidebook for the things that I'd missed, you know, and you could bring back the day in all its detail.
Yeah.
And then you have various opportunities for reflection too.
Yeah.
Like we started our talk there about walking, about the values of walking. At one stage, in the book, there's quite a discussion on death, because I came across this cemetery and it had these long columns, which platforms on top. And where you could light a little fire on the top. And they were, the origin is uncertain, but they are thought to have been of Celtic origin. When, you know, the Celtics, they lit a fire for their, on the top of these columns to light the way for their departed ones, you know, on their way to wherever they were going. And, of course, this was adapted by the Christian tradition, and it's even the basis behind the, you know, like the eternal flame.
Of course.
You know, both sort of in the shrine and other places around the world. And then I thought, I had a habit of wherever I could, when I was walking, of lighting a candle for Maris. And then I thought, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm lighting a candle to help Maris on her way, you know, on her way. So I thought, now after that, yes, this is what I'm doing. I'm lighting a candle for her so that she's got some lamp, some light to see where she's going. In another world. So yeah. I spent a bit of time talking about that. And there were other digressions like that when I, for example, I talk of the, I only went to Mass a couple of times where there was an opportunity, but I used the opportunity to write about why do I go?
Yeah.
You know, when others have given it away, I think of it more in terms of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. But,
yeah.
But I do spend some time in reflection on these.
Yeah.
And going back to the book there, Keep Pressing On, Brother, all my books are dedicated to Maris, but this, and there's a dedication page to her, but in this last book, there's a dedication page to an old friend of mine, a Catholic priest, Peter McGrath, who was our pastor at the church that we went to in Sydney at Terry Hills. And he was a wonderful bloke, you know.
Yeah.
He was a larrikin, mind you. He was unpredictable. But he was an intensely spiritual and wise person in his ways, and he influenced his a lot. He died of dementia, but in one of his last notes that he sent to me, he finished it off with "Keep pressing on, brother," and that's where I got the title for this particular book. I spent some time in the book describing a visit that I made to Peter in the nursing home when he was, you know, well and truly in the dementia, and then also his funeral. I went to his funeral. I don't know how many were there, but thousands, I think. Yeah, because he was such a wonderful bloke, so I had to dedicate that page to him.
Yeah.
And spread that message of keep pressing on, brother, or keep pressing on, sister.
Yeah. You know, when I read the title and brother in the title, it's such a much used term, a term of endearment. Mm. We just don't confine to siblings these days.
No,
and in particular on the Camino, it takes on a sort of familial connotation because so often we find ourselves and consider ourselves and believe ourselves as pilgrims, as a Camino community, to be family, don't we?
Very much so. And this is how I regarded it. And last year, and I write about it in the book, I had the fortune to be a volunteer in two separate refuges in France. And one of them... that I was a volunteer at I was there for 2 weeks. They would provide a bed and they'd provide the breakfast. but not say the evening meal. You know, the people had to either cook it or go and find it somewhere. And I'd said, you know, to the contact person there, I believe we should provide an evening meal because that's where you form family. I said, okay, well, as long as you charge €8 extra and, you know, keep within that there, fine. So I provided a meal every night for the pilgrims who came and stayed with me. I was doing this because I had received such tremendous hospitality along the way.
Yeah.
You know, so it was absolutely wonderful, some of the hospitality, that I wanted to give some back in turn. So here I am in receiving the pilgrim as they arrived. It was my objective to greet them as individuals when they arrived, and in the morning to see them depart as family, because over a meal they were able to bond.
Yeah.
And come together, and I used to gain, you know, great satisfaction of seeing this bonding form. And I was determined to do well, you know, nothing scratch or that. So I had received you know, when I stayed with families, 4-course meals. So that was what I was going to do, provide 4-course meals to these pilgrims. And I thought, well, I'm game because, you know, the French have got a they regard eating and cooking as an art form.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, I'm game here, you know, with cooking for French, although there are a lot of Germans and others there as well. But they didn't – they just appreciated the, you know,
the
hospitality. And that was one of the great things I learned last year, this idea of – hospitality and all the values that represents, you know, of complete acceptance of whoever, of accepting everyone as they come, of tolerating of differences, all of those things. And I saw through a meal that this is the way that one breaks down divisions. And I often used to think that, you know, if you can get a couple of warring parties together over a meal, they could probably sort out their differences over that.
Yeah.
They had the potential to sort out differences.
Yeah, that's it.
And both hospitality and the Camino are forces in the world now that unite and bring people together when there's so many things in the world now that are doing their darndest to separate us all and divide us all. There.
Yeah, that's lovely. That's fantastic.
You
mentioned before that you had walked now 6 Caminos. Do you collect Compostelas at the Pilgrim's Office at the end of
them? Well, I've only got 2. The only twice I've been to Santiago.
Oh, I see. Right.
I've got those 2. But the others I still, you know, I take my, you know, the little credencial or the credencial and get it stamped along the way. Yeah. I've got all those. Well, you need those, of course, because some places won't let you in unless you've got one of them.
No, that's right. Yeah, but they're also great keepsakes, aren't they? Sometimes you pull them out and they just tell the story.
They're beautiful.
And I have a great friend of mine who likes to drop over here for a beer from time to time, and he just loves to grab it and open it up and point to a stamp and say, go on, tell me the story.
Ah, yes.
And I look at it, I look at it, I say, oh, that's, you know, Arzura. That's, you know, and away I go. Then I can tell the story of that day or that night. It's a nice keepsake.
Yeah.
You know, Noel, I'm looking here at the titles of your 3 books, the last 3, The Day Was Made for Walking. I guess I'll just keep on walking and keep pressing on, brother. And I'm taken back to your first novel's title, Friend and Philosopher. And perhaps rather than a book title, it may be what's written on the shingle outside your shop these days, because you have in many ways become the friend and philosopher.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, that's, you know, in my old age, you hopefully develop a little bit of wisdom. I still go off half-cocked every now and then, I'm sure.
You say in the new book you discovered there was more to pilgrimage than simply visiting places.
Yes.
So true, eh?
Yes. Yes. Because the pilgrimage and the Camino is as much about one's inner journey as it is the outward physical journey. And it's a process of continual change as a result of the experience. So it's a sort of like an inner and outer journey constantly interacting with each other. And in particular, the opportunity for walking, as I said, it's like a can be like a mantra, and gives you time for reflection, or just time for pure, you know, clearing your mind and thinking of nothing in particular, just listening to the mantra of your footsteps or of the tap of your walking poles, if you sort of use them there. And I always think of, you know, they say often it's what you can't see is can be the most important influences. And I often think in terms of the other influences that might be accompanying me.
Mm.
On the way, I think of Maris,
of course,
my wife with me. I think of a deity accompanying me as well. Some people describe it as the Camino itself, like a mystical entity. And I will say the Camino will guide you and look after you, and it does. And time again, you get yourself into trouble. And how am I going to get out of this? And something always happens. Some angel comes along. Yeah. That's happened to me. I had a great experience there when I found myself completely lost in the middle of nowhere. There was just stopped raining, so the ground was too wet to sit on. I was in this area where there was no, just wide open fields, couldn't even see animals. And I didn't know where I was. I'd taken a wrong direction anyway. I heard this pop, pop, pop coming along. And along came the French farmers had these little sort of buttes, you know, just with a back big enough to put a bale of hay or a sheep in. Anyway, I hailed this guy, and he was only a young fellow, and I said to him, I mentioned the name of the town that I wanted to get to, and I thought, oh, he said, oh, yeah, that's 10 kilometres over towards the east. I'd completely taken a wrong direction from lunchtime. It was about 4 PM, and I'd run out of water. I should have been where I was supposed to be going. Anyway, he gave me this maze of directions, you know, à gauche, à tout droit, à droit, you know. So off he went. Anyway, so I thought, oh, well, my only consoling thought, it was 4 PM. It wouldn't get dark till about 6 o'clock, till 10 o'clock. So I had almost 6 hours of daylight to find my way. Anyway, I started walking, you know, in the way he said, tout droit, straight ahead. Anyway, 5 minutes later, I heard the pop, 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 and back he was. this young fellow. And the young fellow opened the door and he said, "Monte," which is French, is "hop in." So I hopped in and he chatted all the way, showed me his parents' farm and his grandparents' farm, and we, you know, went all over the place zigzag and dropped me off at the church in the town that I wanted to be, and then hopped in his car and raced off. And I thought, God, this is Jesus himself, you know. A young man who, I don't know, he could have been off to football practice or something.
Yeah.
But he went out of his way. And what's more, he gave me this bottle of ice-cold water there, you know, for a start. So,
oh, how lovely.
I thought, how can I repay this young man for his generosity? And all I could hope that, you know, he'll enjoy his life on that particular farm. He'll meet some nice girl. Have a family, make a contribution to the community that you know he is in, and sort of live a rich life, you know.
Yeah. Right?
And he was an angel. He really was an angel. That young man. His name was Florian. And Florian will be, even though, you know, our encounter was only, you know, 10 minutes or so, I'll never forget him.
Yeah, that's so lovely, isn't it? He's had such an impact on your life.
He did, yeah. You know. Yeah. And you talk to other people on the Camino and they'll tell you similar sort of stories too.
Yeah. That's lovely. So, that's fantastic. Yeah. You know, we could talk for days, you and I. We're terrible.
Yeah.
But I wonder, is it fair to say you're someone who's made a conscious decision to share their story so others might learn from your experience?
Yeah. I've made a conscious decision to share my story so that other people... I see myself as a very ordinary sort of person, but from the feedback, I know that my story has been able to inspire others. And I often used to say to the library talk, when the library talks, that I didn't expect them to all go off and, you know, book the plane and go off on the Camino. But I thought perhaps if, you know, there's some challenge or difficulty that they're facing, and after hearing my talk, they might decide, you know, to keep pressing on. I thought, well, that was a very good outcome for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's many times you can encourage people by, you know, just by a simple thing, term like that, keep pressing on, brother, keep pressing on, sister. And that offers a little bit of encouragement and sort of inspiration. So, and also, of course, when you talk, okay, you're talking to a number of people, but when you write a book, it's no longer in yours. It goes out there, and, you know, how many people read it? Could be thousands.
Yeah.
You know, might read it and feel in some way encouraged by it.
Yeah. Well, the new book is out now. Keep Pressing On, Brother, by Noel Braun. It's available everywhere. You can buy books online is the easiest place to get it. I just typed in Keep Pressing On, Brother this morning and it came straight up. So it's easy to get, and it would be the perfect Christmas present for somebody you know who's thinking of walking the Camino, or somebody who has walked the Camino, or someone you would like to tell about your journey. That's what I found reading it. I thought, this is, you've encapsulated here, as I said earlier, the ability for me to tell a part of my story in your words. So congratulations, Noel, on the book and for the difference that you are making in people's lives, because I think that's taken a great deal of courage and a great dedication on your part. It's not easy to write the books the way you write them, and we explained that earlier. We could talk for days, as I said.
Sure.
Keep pressing on, brother.
And if you go to, if people want to go to my website, they'll find you know, a description of the book and a page where they can order if they so wish. So,
just give us the website for us.
noelbraun.com.au.
Okay, we'll find it. Keep Pressing On, Brother, by Noel Braun. Thank you so much for your time, Noel. I really wish you all the very best, and I look forward to when the COVID restrictions are all thrown in the bin, you and I can catch up again. That'd love be.
Yeah,
that'd love
great.
To. Keep on keeping on. Buen camino.
Thank you. Gracias.
My guest this week was the Australian pilgrim and writer, Noel Braun. The title of the book, again, is Keep Pressing On, Brother. If you Google it, you'll find it. Perhaps it was the call of the spirit luring him into the unknown, where he had to rely on a strength greater than his own to persevere, creating a future, a destination, a pilgrimage. Linda Hogan is an American poet and Indigenous writer, and she wrote, "Walking, I am listening to a deeper way. Suddenly all my ancestors are behind me. Be still, they say. Watch and listen. You are the result of the love of thousands. Walk on, pilgrims, and until next week, I'm Dan Mullins. Buen Camino."